The final agenda item under Division of Wildlife, number 25, walk-in area survey. Baron, are you doing that one?
I am. Why did you not leave?
You've been here so patiently waiting to get up to the battery. Welcome.
While he is pulling this up, I will say good morning and happy new year to Chair and the commissioners. Commissioners, if you're online in East Bay out there somewhere, and Secretary Roebling, I am glad to be here this morning. It is coming up on my 2-year anniversary, but it was 2 weeks before COVID started here, so it's been really weird to get in front of people and meet people, so it's good to see everyone face-to-face. Just real quickly, for those who aren't familiar with what I do, it's probably easy to start with what I don't do. What I don't do are the hunter harvest surveys and a lot of the angler harvest and creel survey work. That's Corey Huxel and some other staff that really handle that. That's their lane. For me, I handle some of the more complex and in-depth surveys, program evaluations for staff, working with the education team on assessing success metrics for their programs. That kind of thing. I do a lot with stakeholder engagement and public engagement processes, collaborative planning and policy. Those are kind of my strengths. So there is a little bit of a difference in what we do, and just kind of wanted to clarify that. Any quick questions before I get started? All right. Well, so this morning you all have invited me here. I'm going to present some select findings from the most recent hunter evaluation of our South Dakota walk-in area. Every 5 years, the walk-in area program does an in-depth assessment from hunter's perspective of their walk-in area uses on the different game types. The first survey was done in 2015, and then we replicated this in 2020 in advance. I'm not used to having somebody advance my slides, so now I'm going to talk forward. Sorry. It's the teacher in me is used to. All right, so we're going to run through this real quick overview. We can get out of here this morning, and a few select findings from this survey. Keep it pretty quick and sweet. There's delay in advancing. There we go. All right, so what we did in 2020, to try to be able to compare data as best we can with previous survey done in 2016, we did replicate the methodology as closely as possible. What this means is that we did a mixed mode survey administration, and that was delivered initially online through email contact and then followed up with a mail survey. What was interesting when I looked at the data in hindsight in terms of the total number of people, it was almost a direct 50-50 split in terms of the number of responses from the online and the number of responses through the mail-based survey. This tells me that it's really important, particularly here in South Dakota, that we continue to do mixed mode surveys. I know there's a lot of pressure to lean towards just doing online electronic surveys, but had in this case, for instance, I chose not to do the mail-based wave follow-up, we would not have had enough survey responses to meet the minimum criteria to do really valid statistical analysis. So it's really important that we continue these mixed mode approaches for some of these surveys in collecting this data. So we followed that as closely as possible. There will be some nuanced differences in comparing the data because we did make a few changes to 2020. Overall, we had a 32% response rate, which I know is a little bit less than 2015. Response rate is one criteria for looking at data. It's not the most important criteria. It also happens to be relative to overall population and sample size. What's really the most important for me is did we get enough surveys to meet that minimum sample size, to be able to do statistical analysis. That's really the most important thing for me. The good news is that both in 2015 and in 2020, we did meet that minimum threshold. And so what that means is that if we did this survey 95 times out of 100, doing the same sample the same way, each time we would get 95 times out of 100, our data would come back plus or minus 2% from what we're reporting today. It's the exact same confidence level and margin of error that we had in 2015. The gold standard is 3 to 2%. Sometimes I see upwards of 5%. It kind of depends. It's a little bit subjective on what you get to pick. So I'm super excited by this plus or minus 2%. It's really tight and representative, good representative data. To get started, one of the things that we did, just as I present this data, I'm presenting it from the perspective of all. I did look at all the data and compared non-resident and resident hunter responses to see if there was any difference between resident hunters and non-resident hunters. There was not. There were a handful of instances in which there might have been, or there was a mild statistically significant difference, but in talking with staff, we recognized that why that may have been. So I am presenting everything from an overall perspective. If you really want detailed analysis, the full report contains all of that, both overall, by resident, and by non-resident. So that's available. All right. So I like to understand kind of who responded and making sure, you know, we're targeting the right target audience. All of those who responded, about 65% of our overall sample were considered resident hunters. From our non-resident sample size, it was pretty impressive. It represented 45 states, everywhere from Alaska to Florida to Maine to California. I was super impressed to see the range of non-responses, or excuse me, non-resident hunters. And about 11% of non-resident folks were Minnesota, so that's kind of our largest non-resident state. On average, across both sample sizes and totals, are about half of our hunters are in that age bracket between 50 and 69. There was another, I think, 14% that was 70 years or older. So we are trending. You know, we've had this discussion in lots of meetings about, you know, age classes, if you will, of hunters and hunters aging and the need to reach back for cohorts. And so this is something to certainly keep in mind. One of the things I wanted to understand with this survey in particular, 2020 was one of those years where, whether we like it or not, COVID may have impacted a lot of behavioral intentions and participations in a number of things. And so to try to hedge that into wondering, you know, what happens if we get data that's really wonky and to try to be able to understand, I wanted to ask folks if they didn't hunt, why they didn't hunt. We generally, sometimes we do ask folks on hunter harvest surveys whether we hunt, they hunted or not, but we don't ask why. And I'm just curious to what degree, what impacts what we would see. Overall, about 12% of folks said they did not hunt. Again, these are all people that were pulled from licenses, our licensing databases. So 12% of those folks said they actually didn't hunt. Of those 12%, roughly about 43% had selected COVID or some kind of relationship to COVID considerations of some sort. Another third or so selected time constraints as being an issue for why they did not hunt. And there was an additional, like, 22% that was kind of a combination of these things or something completely unrelated in this list. But it was interesting for me just to have this information so that we do know that there were some, there's some degree of impact. I can't tell you if this is more or less than the average number of hunters who get a license but don't actually hunt, I don't know. I wanted to get this information for this year to help explain the data.
Was there a demographic difference between the resident and non-resident?
Yeah, so there was a little bit in terms of, like, COVID considerations. If you looked at the non-resident hunters, that was a higher impact, higher proportion of non-resident hunters. Were maybe impacted by this COVID considerations, travel considerations, and maybe non-residents, for sure.
On the 51% or
50%? Oh, no, those were right on.
Both resident and non-resident?
Yeah, they were right in that market. It's in the, I should have brought the breakout. It is in the final report, but they were right on point. That was for both categories.
Wow. Same. Yeah. I would have expected the resident hunter, younger, taking the kids out, and the non-resident are the ones that or doing the hunt trip. So,
yeah, it's nuanced, and so I know we don't spend a lot of time talking about the demographics and the nuances in the data, but I think there's a lot of neat information there about understanding, intentions and what people are doing. I think there's a lot of things that we can mine from our data. Like, I reached out to our staff just out of curiosity to see if we had data on what is the average age range, you know, for our hunters and our license sales. How does this differ from just what's in the database? And while that data is there, we haven't really mined it yet. We're in this place right now where we're transitioning over to Brandt. We're really hoping this new Brandt system will help facilitate being able to come up with these kinds of metrics a lot easier. But we need to let them get that up and running before I start dinging them with data requests on that. But as far as the age brackets and the gender, they were almost right on. purposes of the survey was to look at the over-evaluation of walk-in areas and to look at the future use of it. We also wanted to look at what are some of the things that might have impacted, why they chose, what was their preferred species to hunt, various other things. And so that's what this section is covering. So when we surveyed folks, out of those who responded, roughly half of the respondents said they hunted on a walk-in area at some point during 2020. This is about a 10% increase from what we saw in the 2015 survey data. In terms of satisfaction or dissatisfaction, pretty close, couple percentage point differences from 2015, but three-quarters of folks were somewhat or very satisfied, and then roughly about 12% were somewhat or very dissatisfied with the program. And not surprisingly, almost everybody basically said they plan to hunt walk-in areas in the future. So demand is not going away. And this is kind of segues into this habitat and access that we've been talking about. The demand is there. All right, so we asked, we asked them preferred game species, and just as we saw in 2015, pheasant was the preferred game species to hunt on walk-in areas. There was this in that 10% other in the far corner. That is a combination of folks who either selected every single one of those. They didn't want to select just one, so they selected every single game species category. And then there was a small percentage of those in that other game species category that selected things like rabbit, prairie dog, coyote, other things, elk that weren't necessarily one of our game species that we assessed for this year. But pheasant is still seen. In terms of factors influencing, so we wanted to know, we asked folks to use this Likert-type scale rating of 1 being a no influence and 5 being extremely influential. We wanted to assess what factors might have an influence on their decision-making on whether or not they hunted a walk-in area in 2020. So I briefly want to have a quick, gratuitous explanation of why the mean and mode is presented here. When we look at social science data, the mean or the average, I think most people understand what an average is, right? We're looking for that central middle point of the data. And biologists and engineers, we work in continuous data, so we have these set numbers, and so they have meaning. A 3.5 inches has a meaning. 3 inches has a meaning. 3.5 inches has a meaning. 4 inches has a meaning. We have these set constructs. When we look at this, when we try to measure social science data, we give these numbers to it. But what is really important to me is this data then interpreted and made into recommendations. And so mean is not really the appropriate way to look at these Likert scale. It's useful information in terms of looking at long-term trend data, but in terms of management recommendations, when using mean, it can be misinterpreted. For instance, 2.5 is a mean. Well, that's halfway between slightly influential and moderately influential. So what does that mean? Slightly influential-ish? I mean, you can't really give it a characterization. And if you ask 10 people in this room what 2.5 means in terms of between slightly and moderately, you're going to get 10 different answers on what it really means. So because social science data is a little bit different than dealing with inches or pounds or whatever we're measuring in a biological world, median and mode are the two other descriptive statistics that we really like to use in understanding social science data. And so this is why I've listed mode. And what mode simply means is it is the selection or the category that was most often selected by all of the respondents. So in this case, when we look, let me just real quick question, is there any question about mean and mode and why I'm using mode? Anyone online? Because this will repeat itself a lot. You're going to hear this a lot from me, and you're going to see it a lot in my reports, so this theme isn't going away. All right, so just real quick. So if we look at the mode of these 10 metrics that we had the participants scored, the top 5, I don't have to steer permission to hunt, opportunity to harvest desired species, hunted them in the past, they're easy to locate using maps, and then quality of habitat were all ranked as being very influential factors, was the most often selected choice for those top 5. Conversely, at the other end of the spectrum, the other 5, private hunting. hunting land be close to my home. Friends and family wanted to hunt there, planned or just kind of came across the place, and then no other place near my home were not. We're listed, primarily listed as not influential factors. And so this gives a little bit more clear indication for managers, depending on how they might want to adjust programs or make decisions, where respondents are thinking. One of the other things that's really important, and this ties into habitat and access, is understanding where there is need spatially. So one of the things I wanted to try to understand or try, hopefully try to answer with this question was how important is it to folks, again, on a Likert type scale of not important to five, critical, or would not hunt otherwise, how important is it to folks to have a walk-in area within 30 miles of their home residence? Despite the way the question was bringing, we had people from Alaska commenting on how important it was to have a walk-in area 30 miles from their home. So I had to filter the data by only South Dakota residents just to clean up the data noise, because obviously we can't have a walk-in area 30 miles from Alaska. And what was really interesting, and it represents about 100 addresses across the state, and so three-quarters of South Dakota resident hunters said it's anywhere from moderately to very to critically important that they have walk-in areas within 30 miles or less from their home residence. I did work with the GIS staff to try to spatially map this and look at it. In the larger report in the appendix, those maps are included. However, after discussing it with walk-in area program staff and discussing it with the RSs, it wasn't as helpful in making decisions, but we did map it, and we do have the map, and they are in a larger report. So one of the other things we wanted to look at, what were some of the factors that may have impacted someone's overall hunting experience? It's one thing to ask someone if they're generally satisfied with their experience, but why and what about it is important to understand. So this is the same thing. There were a battery of 10 different statements, and we asked folks to rank whether from not important to five extremely important, where that factor ranks for them. And again, in terms of very important, there was a top four, so, and it's not terribly surprising. So land that's enrolled in high-quality habitat, land enrolled in high abundance of desired game species. The signage, need to be able to see it, and it's readable. And then, of course, land enrolled that provides an opportunity to walk long distances. Those were all ranked as being very important criteria in terms of their overall experience. Next, we have not seeing other people and harvesting game species you'd be proud to display. Those were listed as moderately important factors in terms of their overall hunting experiences or walk-in areas. And lastly, the bottom four, whether or not it had a parking area, whether the land supported the ability of individuals with physical limitations to hunt, whether they had to walk far from their vehicle, and advertising and marketing being about hunting expectations, none of those ranked as important criteria in terms of their overall experience using walk-in areas. One of the things that we also did in this survey, by each section, by upland bird, by upland game, and by waterfowl, we asked those hunters to evaluate walk-in area and prep land. And so when we look at upland bird, what we see is about 23%, almost one quarter, of folks hunted upland birds this year. Sorry, I lost my notes pages. I'm too far ahead of myself. And this is about a 9% increase from what we saw in 2015 overall. In terms of pheasant hunting, in response there, about 75% of our respondents overall said they hunted pheasant in 2020. If you look at just, if you isolate just the resident hunter population, within that category, 71% of resident hunters said they hunted pheasants in 2020, which was interestingly about a 4% decrease from the 2015 survey. And again, and I'll say this 100 times, COVID 2020 did impact behaviors. And so that 4% decrease, we'll see what happens in another 5 years when we redo this, but I really have a sneaking suspicion that much like with you know, when you get an asterisk in the records book. 2020 for some of this data may be an asterisk in the records book, and we'll see how behaviors change back out or flush back out in coming populations or coming surveys on this. And it makes sense, depending on the time of the year, and that a large majority of pheasant hunters are non-residents, I could see where that, you know, we could get a little bit of a decrease. In terms of whether hunters hunted on walk-in areas or prep lands during 2020, about 39% of our hunters said yes. Again, about a 5% decrease. It's kind of comparing apples to oranges a little bit because in 2015, we did not ask about prep lands. We only asked about walk-in area lands, so it's a little bit apples and oranges in comparison. When we look at the evaluation of upland bird hunters, there were four things that we asked them to evaluate on both walk-in area and prep land. And again, so it's whether the importance of those types of lands for that particular hunting, the overall satisfaction of those type of lands, the overall quality of that type of habitat, and then their perception of crowding, which is new for sure in the 2020. This is something to begin to kind of get an assessment of. So when we look at the data, both across walk-in areas and prep for upland birds, they are very important for hunters. Similarly, in terms of overall satisfaction of upland bird hunting, they are somewhat satisfied on both walk-in area and prep land. There's a little bit of a nuanced difference in terms of overall quality of upland bird habitat. So on walk-in areas, they're staying average. On prep lands, they're staying good. And then in terms of crowding perception, this is really great to see. Both walk-in area and prep lands are saying they're not seeing an issue of crowding. The big game hunters. When we looked at deer and antelope, 2015 also included turkey. It was decided this year that we would not assess turkey, so we're only looking at deer and antelope. Both with deer and antelope, I just want to say that non-resident participation was really so tiny that I really couldn't do statistical analysis that would compare non-resident and resident hunters. It's just too lopsided. So we really are presenting the data from an overall perspective. If you want to compare to 2015, then you really need to look at just the resident deer and the resident numbers, and then you're going to try to compare just as a FYI. So over half of all the residents, over half of them said they hunted deer. And then if you look at the residents, about 72%, three-quarters of them. Again, when I looked at the differences between 2015 and 2020, this represents about a 30% increase. We think this is a crazy number and crazy high, and so I've had conversations with Mark about this. I've talked with RSs about this. There's a few things that are a little bit nuanced in there that we think might be just an artifact of 2020, and we'll have to wait and see on 2025 data what it's doing, because we're a little suspicious about that. That's a huge jump, and we're not entirely sure why or if that's confident. With big game antelope, overall, again, about 18% of big game hunters said they hunted antelope. Again, when you look at just the residents, that's about 27%. This is also another fairly substantial increase. It's about 15% increase from 2015. And there may be some explanations in terms of increased license availability and that kind of thing. I'm not entirely sure, but this is another one where we're going to need to watch the numbers and see what they do. In terms of whether they hunted big game on walk-in areas or prep lands, another kind of discrepancy, so we have about almost a third this year, or in 2020, said they did. That's a pretty good drop from 45% that reported they had hunted the big game, including wild turkey again. It's a little bit comparing apples to oranges because they just asked about walk-in areas. We asked about walk-in areas and prep, so it's not a direct apple-to-apple comparison. And again, there may be something in the sampling for why that gap is there. In terms of evaluating walk-in area and prep lands for big game, same criteria as we saw for upland birds, and again, same consistency, very important overall to the game hunting. Same in terms of overall satisfaction, satisfied with pocket area and cropland. Similarly, as we saw with upland birds, there's a little bit of a difference in overall quality, where crop area here is listed as average, and walking areas are listed as good in terms of overall habitat. And then crowding perception, there is a little bit of a nuance difference. Crop lands are say and focus say and not crowded at all. We are seeing a slight uptick, though, in the walk-in area lands, which they're reporting slightly crowded. So this will be something to keep our eye on over the next 5 years, and again, looking forward and just seeing what the trend, where this goes. So this might be something to keep our eye on. And lastly, the last group is waterfowl. And what we see in the waterfowl group is roughly about a third of folks overall participated in waterfowl hunting. What we are seeing is that this represents about an 18% increase from 2015. And again, whether this is a factor of folks having more time to hunt during the COVID time period, not entirely sure what the influence factors are. But we did see an increase here. Overall, when we asked waterfowl hunters if they hunted on walk-in areas or creplands, 10% of the folks said they did. Again, about a 10%, 11% decrease from 2015. And their evaluation of walk-in area and creplands, consistent with the other game species, very important to waterfowl hunting. Consistent with what we saw with the other two game species, overall satisfaction is somewhat satisfied. Overall quality of habitat is good, so I'm both walking area and croplands. And another exciting metric for us is that walking area and croplands are reporting that they're not crowded as well. So that's really nice to see. And lastly, there was a closing question, as well as some other open-ended questions that I didn't cover, but this one was just, you know, if there's anything else you want to tell us about, which y'all will learn about me, is I love qualitative data. I think there's an enormous amount of information that we get from comments. So the process for analyzing qualitative data is an iterative process that I go through and look at the data, and I chunk it up and the comments up and group things by themes. And these will not add up to 100 because, depending on the statement, could hit 10 themes, depending on. Some people had paragraphs and covered a lot of points. But these are just the rough percentages. However, again, in the larger report are examples for each of these categories, the things that I pulled out, as well as in the appendix. All text responses are listed there, so you can see all of them. But I did, because I do love qualitative data, and I like to tell stories with the data, and so I just picked a few ones that were out of some select final comments to just reinforce how important this program is, and that not all folks in the state have access to private lands, and that they really do support it. There are folks out there that can help friends scout walk-in lands, and they really want to see this program continue and expand and really provide more opportunity. So having walk-ins and prep lands help folks keep coming back to hunting. And then, of course, hunters really appreciate this, and it is extremely limited for a lot of folks. And my favorite quote probably, because I love just telling stories, but having walk-in areas that provide places that I can walk with my 11-year-old grandson. So that really hits home for building those memories and building that relationship for the program. So with that, any thoughts, comments, questions?
Commissioner Sharpier, thank you. Very good presentation. Question, can some of this data, is it detailed enough to allow the department and have it help the department determine where we need to focus some additional land purchases for additional access area? I mean, now this was walk-in and more generalized. You had that one slide that showed it was somewhat important to have access within 30 miles of your home. Can this kind of data be used to develop a map to show that we've got some holes in this area so as opportunities exist, we could expand walking in that area, you know, more access type stuff?
Unfortunately, this data does not, because the survey wasn't designed to really look at access broadly. It was more assessment of walk-in area programs.
Okay, then delineate, get down into location.
But that is not to say that we can't look at in terms of strategizing for habitat and access and think of different ways to, particularly in the regions, if we were approaches from a regional aspect and working with each of the regions to identify, work with their landowners and maybe try to prioritize areas that might be of need for that particular region. I think there are strategies. I think there are things that we can discuss and come up with that might help us inform that. Yeah.
Okay, and then one final question. And I've got it on my phone. I tried to go through it quickly, and I wasn't able to get to it. But was a question asked about parking? Because I know it comes up where people go, gee, I really like this GPA or walking area, but there's no parking, so I'm parking on the side of a gravel road. It sure be nice if we took out an acre and made parking available.
Yeah, so the way we had that discussion when we developed the survey, and the way that the question ended up coming out was, or the statement was, a designated parking area that is not far from the hunting area. That is not the same thing as saying a designated parking area for safety. You know, that's a different way of measuring or asking, and we did not ask specifically about that. I will say, however, in comments, anecdotally, what I can see is I did see people say, hey, it would be nice. There are, for some of these, there is nowhere to park, and it is a danger issue. And for some folks, so I think there may be for some, and maybe that's something, and I don't know, and I don't, if we can look at that by a WIA perspective, like which one, like if we can identify where there are ones. But yeah, I think it's going to continue to be an issue though, particularly as our hunters age.
That's where it's coming up.
Yeah, I think
the ability to run down the ditch with a bag full of decoys and jump the fence is waning in your later years. So.
No, yes, sir. And you know, and again, if you look at this, you know, clearly it says it's very important to be able to have opportunities to walk long distances. That's an important criteria in terms of their overall experience. But I will say, again, looking at this data, when you start looking at the data by, you know, hunter type or that kind of thing, there are some comments in the comment section for, I would say, the older age class of hunters that are starting to look for not having to walk too far or not being able to have to drag the critter too far or, like, for some folks that were mostly upland bird hunters, they actually wanted smaller parcels that were closer together because the idea of going out and kicking around the field and seeing if anything's there, it's not. And you kind of go to the next one, you hop to the next one and kick around the field. And so that's a different perspective in terms of spatial analysis and size than maybe the big game hunters who wanted.
Right.
And so that's hard from a program management perspective to try to meet everybody, that every walk-in area meet every kind of.
Right. Some walking areas are going to be more acclimated towards deer, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So, okay.
Yeah.
Great presentation. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Commissioner Reese here. Was there any questions asked about the quality of the walk-in area? You know, how well the hunters rated certain ones, and if there was poor ones, did we not identify those? So maybe we can go and rent that one again to where we move that funds to somewhere it might be better?
So we didn't have the ability to ask about specific walk-in areas. It's a really long list. I can say anecdotally, again, in the qualitative data and in the comments, there are numbers of places where counties and places are named, where they say, these are some places where we would like more, or this is some places where I've had a particular issue. If there was related to law enforcement or anything in that regard, those comments reported to law enforcement for them to address. But we weren't able to really analyze it by each walk-in area specifically. But there are comments where people definitely teed off on certain ones, and that's in the text. But does that answer your?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Tom Kirsch from the Wildlife Division Director, and Commissioner Beast, in respect to that question also, couple of things I would add to that. Number one, we're constantly challenging our staff to look at those walk-in areas, evaluate them each year that they enroll. We hear comments from sportsmen. That was one of the reasons why we added on our website also the ability to go in and provide comment directly to our agency on walk-in areas or game production areas, what they liked, what they didn't like, what they had concerns, questions about. And those can be very specific and site-specific. So, for example, you were out hunting a walk-in area in Butte County. I'm just arbitrarily throwing that out. And you had concerns or just you didn't think that it met the criteria or it should even be enrolled in the walk-in area. You could go on the website, interactive map, pinpoint that walk-in area specifically and provide your comments to us. And then we use that information, have conversations with the landowners, our staff, and we can evaluate those individually as they come about as well. So it's another tool we have in place to evaluate some of those sites out there. And those have been very helpful because we've gotten good comments on both GPAs and walk-in areas from our users out there.
Final question. Anytime we talk about walk-in areas, crap, or any of that, that, you know, it seems like in the sportsman community, I always hear, and I know my fellow commissioners do as well, about landlocked land.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that was absent from your survey and or the report here, but did you, in the comments portion of any of your retrieval of data or your surveying, hear from people that mentioned landlocked land? Because I know it's not going away, I guess, almost monthly, at least one inquiry from somebody about landlocked and what we're doing to open those up and provide better access to those. So,
yeah, I can't tell you what proportion right off the top of my head, but I can certainly go through the data and look. But there were definitely comments, both in the open-ended question. There was a question where we asked a battery of factors that influence their overall hunting experience. And then we asked them an open-ended question to follow up. Is there anything else? And so that was one place, in addition to the open-ended comments at the end, where we did see the opportunity to tee off on a lot of topics. But landlocked lands is always there. It shows up, you know, in my ELK surveys. It creeps up in the comments regardless of survey. But I'm happy to pull those and isolate those for you if you would like to see them. Just let me know.
Well, I know we're constantly trying and working on that. We've had, you know, years and years worth of discussion about that. And I think that we're gaining ground. I really do believe that. But I think that if the technology were there for people to rent a drone and have them drop them in on some of these landlocked ones, they'd certainly do it because they have thought of more creative ways to get onto these lands. maybe Amazon packaging is going to come with a pickup somebody and drop them in. But I know we're making strides with that, and I think that it's got to be a constant and continued effort to open those lands up because, you know, there winds up being a safe haven for the landowners that have land all around and they shouldn't use it on them all. Otherwise, let's get rid of the land.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, John Canta again. It is still a huge priority for us. And when we talk about habitat and access, landlocked public land access is absolutely in that. You're right. We've given you updates in the past. We've done some great things in the last 5 years, opened up a little over 35,000 acres of landlocked public land, and we're still prioritizing several areas, particularly out in western South Dakota where there's a lot of BLM and grassland and such. But, you're absolutely right. A lot of folks want access to that, and, they're riding bikes. It's crazy the way they're accessing some of this. And unfortunately, though, in a lot of those situations where there might be a section line or something like that, it's not well-defined, and we're having some issues with them getting crossways with landowners and such. And so it's important that we continue to focus on it. And, it's absolutely a top priority for us.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Spring.
Do you have any data on people that have the walk-in areas on success rate with big game?
I do not. We did not ask about hunting effort in this survey because hunting effort is usually covered in the hunting harvest surveys. And I don't know if they're able to look at that data and connect hunting licenses with certain walk-in areas. I'm not sure how that works. On the hunting harvest side, I would have to ask Corey.
Wondering, just in our area, the stream of people going from one walk-in area to the other, there's not that many deer in the whole area.
Yeah, Commissioner Spring, we don't have anything specific to walk-in areas. We do have some information to suggest whether they hunted public or private, some percentages at that level.
We do survey some specific areas. One that pops in my mind a little bit different than what you're talking, but our elk access areas in the Black Hills, those are actually quite successful. We see that, you know, 40 to 50% of the elk harvested in those units are on those elk access areas. So those seem to be working very well. You know, I don't have a good number for you on walk-in areas in your area, but we do know that some of them get a lot of use. And, you know, when we look at satisfaction of hunters, having that place to go and get out there and hunt is a good part of that satisfaction. Then we talk about harvesting an animal and success rates. But, yeah, nothing specific for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have one last gratuitous thing to say. If anybody's interested in learning more about what we do with conservation social science and here at the agency and what we've done for the last 20 years, this summer myself and my intern created a story map called Conservation Social Science, Balancing the Needs of People with Needs of Wildlife. And it articulates why social science is important and then highlights on the landscape places where we've used the data over the last 20 years to balance the needs of people with wildlife. And so the link is there. It's pretty neat, I gotta say. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Great presentation.
Oh, yeah.